Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is not a diving podcast with Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. Welcome to episode 99, nearly 100 down. Wow, that is a serious achievement. Well, it will be if we make it to 100. But nonetheless, yeah, 99's a lot. So yeah, I guess we'll just keep playing on, shall we? I think that's all we can really do. We are approaching the holiday period. It's slightly unclear at this stage what we're going to be doing next week on the show. We might have a break. We might do a Christmas special, or there might be the 100th episode. I think it's unlikely that the 100th episode will be next week, though. It's Boxing Day, the 26th, next Tuesday. I think the most likely thing, which has to be decided imminently, of course, but hasn't been decided yet, the most likely thing is that there will be a non-typical episode of the pod next week, and then we will continue with episode 100 on what will be the 2nd of January, 2024. Wow. 2024, that seems like a futuristic date, and technically it is, but yeah, not as much as it seems. Anyway, this week on the show we have two guests, one of whom is a repeat guest and he's come back specifically to talk about one thing in particular. That is Ben Morris, previously of episode 63 on the show. He is from Kudos Distribution and is just a general all-round music guy. We're talking to him about Salt, and specifically the big Salt show that happened in London last week that everyone in the UK industry is talking about. Probably quite a bit outside the UK too, but it is very much a UK music industry thing, the Salt project. So a bit of an explainer on that, and then we get deep in the weeds on exactly what happened at that show last week. It sounded pretty amazing, and I wanted to get on someone who was there to talk about it. Basically, so that's what we're doing first. And then after that, a much longer chat with James Jackson, aka Jacko of Listen Up, talking radio plugging. Radio plugging is not something we've covered too deeply on the show before, so we wanted to do this for a while, and Jacko is just the number one man to do that with. So yeah, that's the guts of this show. But before that, let's welcome Ben Morris. Ben Morris, how are you doing, sir?
Good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, very well, very well. So yeah, just wanted to chat about this Salt show. But actually, I wanted to chat about Salt generally as well, because it's come to my attention, having tried to talk to a lot of people about this, is that it's seemingly every single person in London loves Salt and knows about Salt, but outside London, quite a lot of people just don't know anything about it. So tell me about the whole thing, or tell the audience about the whole thing generally.
Okay, well, they got brought to my attention during lockdown. Really, a good friend of mine, Al, who has very sort of similar taste in music to me, recommended it. And it was one of those things where you kind of see it everywhere and you're like, what is this? Maybe I should check it out. And I checked out the album untitled Rise, and it just knocked me sideways. The production on it, it kind of harked back to Charles Stepney, Motown, but it also sounded very now as well. And I think, you know, the sort of oldest trick in the book, the burial trick, no one knew who they were. So I think, you know, a lot of people were at home, they had a lot of disposable income, and it happened at the right time. I mean, I think there's some other political aspects of it too, that they came out with this music in the aftermath of George Floyd with this very strong message as well. And I think it definitely resonated with a lot of people as well. So, you know, as you do, you kind of do some digging to find out who it is. And there's their singer, Cleo Soul, as well, who, you know, you can tell that's her voice singing on a lot of the tracks. Little Sims,
yeah,
as well, who everyone knows. But everyone was trying to suss out who Inflow was, the seeming mastermind behind it all. And he's done production for Adele, a lot of Little Sims' stuff, a lot of Cleo Soul stuff.
He was discovered by the guy from the Kooks, I realised.
Yeah.
Today, which is amazing. You know what? I went down a Kooks rabbit hole this afternoon. I didn't realise how big the Kooks are. They're still pretty big. Like, compared to those other sort of 2000s bands with the in the title, like, they're pretty popular. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, yeah, he produced their 2014 album.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. It's on the list to check out, but
it's pretty good, actually. It's definitely listenable.
I listened to the tracks he did with Adele as well. And yeah, the production on them is just insane. So, you know, he's clearly a very talented individual. And I think one thing I can't suss out is that I think since 2019, I think the first Salt record came out.
Yep.
Since then, they've dropped 11 albums, five of which on one day.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, so I kind of wonder if all this is like a life's work, which they're releasing as and when, or whether they've just got this insane work rate. I can't suss it out. And part of me doesn't want to suss it out either. You know, you just kind of enjoy it when it happens. But yeah, big fan of their music. Their music is, even the two, one's called Air and one's called Air, but spelt with two I's. So it's a sequel. And, you know, they're sort of classical pieces, and even they're really good as well. But listening to those and then listening to some of the other Inflow productions, I'm kind of getting the vibe that these were all done in one session, and some of it was used on productions for other people, and some of it was for these albums. He kind of must have made the most of his studio time and having these resources to hand, and made it all in one go, then chopped it up later on, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a little bit of digging too today. I was trying to figure out whether there's a label, you know, a big label behind this, or whether there's some kind of, you know, unseen hand, even more unseen than can be sort of found out about. But apparently there isn't. Apparently he funds it all himself. And presumably, yes, like you say, like when he's able to go into big studios to do something like an Adele project, he presumably, you know, uses that time to kind of do some other stuff. I mean, that's a complete guess, but and that's what I would do. Do you know what I mean? If I was doing something like that.
That's my read of it as well. Yeah. Yeah. He's got to be using these resources. Maybe on someone else's coin. Fair play. If so.
I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with, you know, taking an extra couple of hours at the end of the day. If it's available, then why the fuck
absolutely
not?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So they did this gig, this show. Was it last week? It was
last Thursday.
Yeah. So tell us about the show, because the show really got people talking.
It did. And
in lots of different ways.
In lots of different ways. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they announced it 2 days before they put the tickets on sale. And then the tickets went on sale on Monday for the show that was on Thursday. It was £100. You know, there's no getting around the fact that that is a lot of money, you know, in this economic climate. It's a big ask of people.
I have to say, though, because that definitely was the pushback from lots and lots of people online. And yes, it is. But, you know, compared to other tickets, it's not ridiculous. Like, when you compare it to, I don't know, any big gig in London, certainly anything of any scale. Like if you go to
the, it's not, no.
If you go to the O2 to see someone, or even if you go to Wembley Stadium, I mean, you're going to be paying, I mean, the most expensive tickets are vastly higher than that. But was it just a straight 100? Was there no...
It was £99. There was no booking fee or anything on top of that.
And no like different levels to it. There's no VIP option or whatever. Yeah, okay.
That was it. So I could only get one ticket, much to my wife's dismay, because she's a big fan as well. So I was like, okay, guess I'm flying solo then. I think what they created was... It wasn't your traditional show. It was, you know, and I'm sure everyone's seen the Instagram posts from everybody like Giles Peterson and Benji B and people like that have done these gushing Instagram posts. It was more of a interactive experience than it was a show. You walked in, sort of anyone who hasn't seen the videos, you walked through a performance arts piece to get to the venue.
Yep.
So there was actors, there was a garden laid out. How much this must have cost?
Right.
Must have been five times what they made off ticket sales, basically. It was insane. And then you walk in the venue and there you could sort of, what they'd done, what I thought was really good, I was talking to one of the girls behind the bar because there was no alcohol either.
Right.
They weren't serving alcohol. It was an 18-plus event, but they weren't serving alcohol.
That must have been something to do with the venue and licensing and stuff, right?
Could be, yeah.
Maybe.
You know, I mean, yeah, it could be. I don't know. I don't know whether it was an artistic sort of decision or whether it was, you know, Thursday night at the venue.
Right.
Don't know. Guess we'll never know. But I was chatting to one of the girls behind the bar, and she said, oh, normally this place, it's a shell. You know, it's an old IKEA, but they sold 3,000 tickets where it normally holds, I think it's 12 to 15,000.
Right.
Yeah. It's a massive venue. And the installations that they had there, it must have run into millions.
Right.
You know, what they did. So my only sort of thinking of it can be, are they taking this show elsewhere as well? Now they've got these sets built, and are they going to take it to other venues? But with something like this, it's got to be that size of venue that can accommodate it as well, because it's a big production.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So could you just describe in a little bit more detail what it was like in there? So there was obviously a lot of music, but did everyone sit down at some point and watch the same thing, or how much of moving around was there and all that stuff?
No, I think a lot of it was they undersold on the tickets, so people had space to walk around and see the various parts of it, because on the left-hand side, there was a pit for a full orchestra. So you could walk around there and you could see there was a 50, 60-piece orchestra in one side. And kind of in the middle of it was almost like a catwalk, like you'd get at a runway show. There was a catwalk with a stage at the end, which was in the center of the crowd. On the right-hand side was a stand, and there was a 75-person choir.
Wow.
And big video screen behind the stage. In the middle of the crowd was almost like an octagon with a garden round it, which was glass, and you could see there was instruments in there. There was a drum kit and a keyboard and stuff in there. And at one point during the night, you could see people being led through the crowd wearing balaclavas and sunglasses who went into this octagon. Then the glass kind of steamed up, so you couldn't see it was in the middle of that.
Okay.
As well, which had seating all round it as well. So you could sit round this octagon and look inside that. You didn't know where to look half the time. Do you know what I mean? You were like,
was there one kind of central performance going on, or was it multiple things happening at once?
So there was like three distinct parts to it. There was the beginning with the choir and the orchestra, which was material from the two sort of orchestral albums that they've done.
Mm.
Then there was the Acts of Faith bit, which was, from what I understand, it was a new album, which you're only going to hear once. They're not going to release it, and that's it. If you weren't at the gig, and aside from clips on social media, you're never going to hear it again.
Right. I mean, I'm getting full-on KLF vibes from this whole thing, to be honest.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And apparently I heard someone told me that Giles Peterson messaged the label and said, hey, one of these tracks that you played, can I get it for my radio? I want to play it on the radio show. And they were like, no, you don't understand. That's it. That's the only time that's getting played. It's done.
Wow.
And then after that, it was, so they brought out all the guests, you know, there was Little Sims, Michael Kiwanuka, Chronix as well, all wearing disguises, but you could very sort of clearly tell it was them.
Right.
And I'm sure I saw Inflow playing the drums on one song as well. You know, there's like two pictures of him online. One's like a close up of his face and the other's him on a drum kit. And someone pointed out to me, it's like, oh, that's Inflow. And I think he was playing the drums on one song. And then after that, it was like a conventional performance, but there was dancers, there was multiple piece drum ensembles, like a Batacuda Brazilian drum ensemble playing as well. They had dancers with boxes because Salt, everyone thought Salt was the band's name, but it turns out it's an acronym.
Yeah.
So these dancers came out with these boxes with letters on and they did a performance and it spelled out what the acronym meant, which is Start a Universal Love Trend. And everyone kind of lost their mind when they showed that at the end. And then the last sort of hour, it was probably a 2.5 hour, 3 hour show.
Yep.
And then the last hour was kind of like the power hour with all the hits, which no one thought they were going to play, but they powered through all the well-known tunes, finished with Wildfires, which is like their most sort of streamed tune on Spotify. And then that was it. It was done.
Right.
Everyone sort of left.
Like at the end, was there a big kind of traditional concert ending, everyone takes a bow kind of thing and waves to the crowd?
No.
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 Yeah, okay.
That was it. It was done. Because a lot of the time, Cleo Soul would come out and sing on the stage in the middle of the crowd, but she was wearing a balaclava and sunglasses for one of them. And another time she was like, the only way I can describe it is like Lady Jessica from June, where she had chainmail over her face and stuff.
Yeah,
it was pretty wild. It was definitely the wildest sort of show I've ever seen. And the amount of planning and logistics that must have gone into it, it can't be a one-off. There's got to be other shows in other countries.
Was there filming going on, obviously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was professional. It was being professionally filmed.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, there was. I'm sending you some pictures after we're done. There was booms over the crowd with cameras, right, and stuff as well. My closest comparison would be like the opening ceremony for an Olympic event, that sort right. of level of things, but with way better music. I think Giles Peterson summed it up best where he said, kind of, look, this wasn't a money-making exercise. It was about the myth.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like people are still talking about it now. Clearly, if that's what they were going for, objective achieved, you know, because people are going to be talking about this for years.
Totally. So yeah, who was there? What was the crowd like?
It was a very diverse crowd.
Okay. So it didn't feel too industry?
Not really, no. I think everyone was kind of too busy picking their jaws up off the floor to feel, you know, elitist or anything like that. Everyone was kind of sort of sharing this mad experience together and sort of looking at each other going, what the fuck is going on?
Wow.
Yeah, very refreshing, you know, and I think hopefully that will set a new standard, you know, for kind of people to up their game a bit as well.
Yeah,
know?
I mean, I hear you, but it doesn't usually work like that, does it? Because, I mean, these kinds of things, these kind of real conceptual, meticulously executed, like artistic statements, I suppose, they're just really hard to do, I suppose, aren't they? Really, that's the bottom line. And not just hard, they require a level of strategic thinking, which is just very unusual.
Yeah.
You know, and like KLF is the only one I can really think of that is really in the same kind of ballpark, if you're talking about kind of the UK, quote unquote, underground music.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. That's a really good comparison, actually, to kind of, not so much hoodwink people, but sort of lull people into thinking, have I just paid £100 to watch, you know, a four-piece band on a stage, keep their mouth shut about it, and then go, here you are, once you walk in the venue.
Right.
You know, knowing that all this is going to be shared on social media and things like that as well. It's very, very clever.
Yeah, fascinating, man. It'll be interesting. Very, very interesting to see, like you say, what happens next, whether it's a you can imagine it being a kind of Netflix thing that pops up, you know, something like that.
Yeah, I don't know, because that kind of goes against their sort of whole anonymity, it's all about the music rather than us sort of thing. But let's see, it was definitely being filmed.
Yes. Well, it sounds like you enjoyed it, man. So,
oh man, yeah, my wife is sick to death of me, like showing her videos and stuff. So, my friends, they're all sick to death of it as well. So,
fair fucks. Well, yeah, man, thanks for coming on to talk about it.
Nice one, mate.
Okay, yeah, Salt, as in SAULT. Lots of links in the show notes to the relevant stuff. I'm not sure if I was being completely unfair when I said that it's a massively London-centric thing. I suspect that it probably is. I don't know. It's definitely a UK thing, and it feels like a London thing. But I'm really interested by the question of how wide they even want to take that project and how wide it wants to go. I mean, the music is really, really great. But it's, you know, conceptual in nature and very mysterious and very not hard sell. And it almost feels a bit 20th century like that in its approach to publicity anyway. It's just not really how things are done these days, which makes it even cooler, I have to say. That's not a dig on it at all. It's absolutely up my street in that respect. So yeah, fascinating. And yeah, check out the music if you haven't done so already. And there's just tons of videos and stuff online from the show. It really does sound like it was awesome, and kind of gutted that I wasn't able to get there myself. Oh well, moving on. We haven't done an industry insider type episode for a good while now, and we haven't really discussed radio on the show too much before either. So this week's guest is an absolutely perfect person to remedy both those two things. It's James Jackson, aka Jacko, from Listen Up, which is one of the foremost promotions companies in the UK. They do club, radio and press, but I think they're most well known for radio, and the name of the agency suggests that. They originally started off as a purely radio plugging outfit, and they've gradually expanded. But yeah, Jacko joined near the start and is now managing director of press, club and radio. So he's one of the main men at that company, and as such is very well placed to discuss all the episodes around it. So yeah, despite the fact that they do press and club, we are definitely focusing on radio in the conversation this week. We get pretty deep in the weeds on how radio works, particularly in the UK. We don't talk too much about other territories in this episode. It's very UK focused. But I mean, even if you're not in the UK, you will find it interesting too, because the UK radio sector is arguably the world's leader, and many of the major radio stations, particularly the BBC ones, are available overseas too and are widely listened to overseas. So it's really fascinating digging into that stuff, how exactly it works, the playlist structure on radio as opposed to streaming playlists. Like when we're talking about playlists on this episode, we're talking about the playlisting that determines what gets played on the sort of big daytime shows on the big radio stations. Obviously, after a certain time at night, it goes specialist and the playlists aren't directly relevant. But as we hear, what goes into the playlist is influenced by what happens on those shows too. So it's just a very interesting area. We also talk about other things which influence the radio ecosystem, like streaming, like TikTok, like socials in general, the way in which different size artists view radio. Jacko does Doja Cat in the UK, so we get an insight into working with a really, really huge act. And just, yeah, he knows his stuff, obviously, and is a great person to talk to about this. So, yeah, it was great to have him on. I guess we'll jump into it, shall we? I haven't done my usual plug for the Patreon and subscriptions and all that stuff yet. So just if you're interested in supporting the show directly, then just check the links in the show notes. I won't go on about it too much here. But patreon.com/scubaofficial and scubaofficial.io/support is where you can do it. But without further delay, here is James Jackson, a.k.a. Jacko. Jacko from Listen Up, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good, mate. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yes. Yes, I am good. So, yeah, we were just talking off mic about what I might be asking you about. And obviously, we're talking about radio because you are. Well, in fact, let's just kick off by you introducing yourself a little bit. So why don't you tell the audience who you are?
I'm Jacko. Everyone calls me Jacko anyway. I run a radio plugging PR company, I suppose. I don't really get involved in the press side of the business. Myself and Luke Neville run a radio plugging company, I suppose. It's pretty niche. But I try and explain this to people. Essentially, it's PR for radio, I suppose. Mm. We get hired to buy record labels, managers, artists, to get their records played on radio. And that's not like we are like geniuses. I always say it's PR, not ER, but it's more like the relationships that we have and what we, you know, where we've come from, I suppose. We're a trusted source of new music.
So yeah, Listen Up is primarily radio. Is that correct? It's only started off as radio, didn't it?
It started off as national radio. I was at Defected Records for about 8 years, finished there as a promotions manager. And a friend of mine was Luke Neville, who was, you know, he's an old school guy, he's been around, he was A&R at Manifesto, whatever. He set up a radio plugging company, which was just daytime national radio. And essentially at that time, there was a lot of labels, a lot of artists starting to do their own labels in the more sort of, I suppose, for the want of a better word, EDM lane. Mm. Obviously, everyone had labels and always has had labels, but I think in that lane, there was a lot more money to spend on promotion and marketing and social media because they were all doing these main stage gigs and what have you. And essentially, I was working a lot of those labels via Defected's label services, sort of by default, but that was kind of coming to an end. And he approached me about, you know, well, actually, I approached him about potentially going and working with him and doing more of a specialist focus, because specialist radio became really important for setting up sort of potential crossover records, I suppose.
Ah, right, okay.
And at that point, there was only one other company really doing it, Your Army, who were great at it. But Luke didn't. He just did daytime radio. So he was doing, you know, I hired him to do Dennis Ferrer, Hey Hey, and 10 Snake Cobra Cat while I was at Defected. So that sort of relationship just formed there.
Okay, yeah. So just to clarify the thing about specialist radio, because that's something which I guess is not necessarily obvious. So for a company like yours, using specialist radio as a kind of conveyor belt or as a kind of incubator, actually,
yeah,
to generate those kind of bigger hits, that's the point of a company like yours focusing on specialist radio to the extent that you do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's two different lanes. I think that it's sort of morphed into that now. Before, everyone wants the profile. It's like where everyone wanted like press and press coverage and online press coverage. It was a similar sort of thing. Like artists, producers, essentially in a specialist lane, in whatever lane that is, you know, appreciate the value of airplay at radio, you know. And I think, you know, there's money to be made in PPL and whatever. But there's also, you know, the profile it gives you, the nod of Pete Tong or back then Annie Mac, or, you know, it was always... It was more of a profile thing. It was also a nod of respect. And, you know, a lot of people looked at it then and they still look at it now. And I think it's just overall exposure in a sort of more mainstream space. But we use, you know, specialist records are, you know, there are records that could get 60, 70 plays at somewhere like Radio 1 that don't go on to be massive hits. I think more recently, Radio 1 have probably been more receptive to those bigger specialist records having a bit of limelight on daytime radio. But largely, if it's a dance record, it's got to start somewhere, and that's normally in a specialist show, whether that's Danny Howard or whether that is Sarah Story or, I suppose, even Jack Saunders and Clara. Mm. It just depends what lane it is, really, and what the strategy is, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that you use the exposure word, especially in comparison to press, because, I mean, I think that maybe the key difference between radio and press is that, you know, press, I think, is a kind of status thing for a lot of people. And I think it's actually a good way of looking at press. Certainly from a label's perspective, a great press campaign, it's not tangible at all in the wider campaign of a record. But with radio,
yeah,
I mean, radio really can go somewhere. Like, it's obviously everyone likes being played on Radio 1. Everyone likes, you know, hearing Pete Tong read out their name.
Yeah.
But actually, it's potentially more than that too. So I guess that's the difference, right?
Yeah. And look, it's about growing a project, you know, growing a release and developing it into a broader market. I think, you know, back in the day, like, you know, you promote pre-promoted records, like the record was released almost at the end of the campaign because you promoted it so hard to get into a point where it was able to then, when you released it, everyone just went and bought it because the only place you could hear it was radio at that point, or if you had a vinyl promo. Whereas now you have to build campaigns while it's releasing. So everything has to sort of grow alongside it, I suppose.
Right.
You know, streaming has become we can talk about streaming, but I think streaming's become something that I talk about daily. And we only sort of really sort of work in a small area of the streaming, I suppose. Labels really sort of have to fight to build records alongside the radio because the radio is purely about passion.
Sure.
From that presenter, I suppose, you know, like playlists on streaming. Does that make any sense? Does that come across in the right way? I'm trying to explain it.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Yeah, it absolutely does. Right. Yeah, totally. So what's the biggest record on the radio in the UK right now?
Dance record?
No, what's the biggest record, just generally?
Mariah Carey at this time of year, to be fair.
That was my next question. I was going to ask about Christmas.
I think it was a quote the other day, it was like 32 Christmas songs out of the top 40.
Right, it's already there. So okay.
32 records in the top 40 are Christmas songs. Actually, we've got one of the eight that isn't, but that's a very commercial sort of kind of pop dance vibe.
Okay. Is that the biggest dance record?
Yeah, it probably was until last week, I think. I think it probably is the biggest dance record. It was a record by like a kid just out of uni. He's a guy called Casso, really nice guy. He did a bootleg while he was in uni. By the time he'd finished uni 6 weeks later, he'd got signed by Ministry and had Ray, who we also do as a solo artist, and D Block Europe featuring on his record, which went top 30 in its first week.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I think like that again, that shows like sort of the impact of like SoundCloud and radio, really, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. Well, this brings
and that's
yeah.
That sat at number two for like 6 weeks. I think it was really the Beatles that kept him off number one, you know, that brand new act in the UK.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this brings us neatly onto my next line of inquiry, which was like, what constitutes a hit record today? Has it changed? And how do you get there? So that's three questions. But like, yeah, what is a hit record? What's your definition of a hit record today in 2023?
I don't know. A hit record, you can still have gold, silver, platinum records that never really see radio. Not ones that I've worked, obviously, but a hit record. I suppose there's a difference between a hit and a crossover record. A crossover hit.
Right.
Is probably the best way to do that. And look, that's not solely what I do or what we do as a team. It's a hit is, you know, a hit is really is a number one record. Mm. That's the ultimate goal with any sort of commercial record. But like I've had, you know, we had number six record with MK this year, like, and Sonny Federa, which was, you know, that was a very specialist record that didn't cross over because it never got added to Capital FM. So it never really crossed into the ultimate commercial space, I suppose.
I mean, the charts are compiled differently to how they used to be, aren't they? I'm not completely sure how it works now, but there's quite a few different things that go into it now, which, I mean, it was used to be a fairly simple metric, and it's a little bit...
Yeah, sell CDs, sell vinyl, get a chart.
Yeah.
I think now, there's obviously, I think it's... I'm going to get shot for not knowing this, but it's probably, I think it's about 1,000 streams or it's either 1,000 streams or I think it's 1,000 streams that are calculated as one sale. So if you bought a CD or a download, I think it's 1,000 streams. So streams obviously are very important. And I think that's, you know, it's obviously controlled by sort of probably three or maybe four main platforms, as you know. Hmm. But I think... chart-wise, it's very different. But that's, again, the reason, like, you know, we have to build campaigns. You know, we have to really get records to a place that are sort of at 60, 70 plays before you're really even hitting that sort of playlist sort of situation or even conversation, really. But there's very sort of, you know, there's very specific strategies that we will do for depending on what records we do. So we will do Ray, for example, who left her deal with Polydor and became a solo artist and did a deal with Orchard. You know, we've we've worked her since that point, and the strategy there was really to build her profile at Radio One.
Sorry, just if I can just jump in there, just to clarify, and particularly for people from outside the UK, Radio One, like explicitly Radio One, that being the most, very much the most important thing, right?
Not at all, actually.
Okay.
It's important, obviously, massively to every campaign because it's national radio and it's actually, you know, it's broadcast internationally. You can live in a more specialist world in radio because in Radio One, because Radio One isn't commercial radio. They don't sell adverts to make money because it's license payers.
Yeah.
So they can be diverse in terms of what they can be much more diverse in terms of what they broadcast. But commercial radio is as important with a pop song or a commercial song. I think, you know, Kiss and on a specialist level, Kiss definitely sort of worked very hard at that. I think even Capital Dance now is like a more, you know, it's obviously a slightly more commercial than Radio One in certain spaces, but Radio One's, it's always been like the sort of the target because it was national radio. I think now everyone wants everything, if I'm honest.
So sorry, I interrupted you because I think the question about how you go about building a campaign is a really interesting one. And yeah, you were just in the middle of that example. So yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I think that's right. With Ray, it was very different. Like we'd done a lot of sort of acts in the sort of R&B, hip hop, sort of rap space. We worked Doja Cat's last 2-3 albums and multiple other artists. And Ray was sort of kind of one we wanted to sort of build as a, you know, a proper hit artist proposition. And that comes from, you know, really working with Radio One to try and sort of engineer the fact that she is that, and talking to music team and producers and presenters, and starting with, you know, finding her home, i.e. like, you know, she had a story to tell. We set up the first record of this new project. We set up a hottest record with Clara Ampho to for her to be able to go into Radio One and tell the story about what was behind her reason for leaving her label. And that created exposure, heat, which everybody wanted to buy into and everyone thought was a very cool thing for her to have done. And I think from there, that was a catalyst to sort of heat on specific singles to where she is now, which is next level. Mm. All in probably like the last, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years tops.
Sure.
That's one space. And then you obviously have the more specialist space where you'll build a dance record.
Yeah.
Which, you know, comes from a hottest record with Danny, I suppose, or a track ID with Sarah, or Essential New Tune still has its, you know, has its place. Probably a bit more underground these days. Mm. And building out long-term campaigns from that, building up record radio plays and getting other shows to play it from the back of the heat of, you know, a hottest record.
Okay, so let me ask you, just going back to Ray for a second.
Yeah.
There was obviously a wider strategy. Radio was obviously part of a wider strategy for building her up as an artist.
Yeah.
So what were the, for you, going into Radio One and talking to the relevant people and your, I guess, pitching work, like what are the most significant things that support a pitch of that sort or support a kind of like a wider story that you can then sell? Like what are the most important things that an artist does to generate that kind of interest at radio?
I suppose a story, you know, a reason for someone, for presenters and producers to buy in to the artist. Obviously, the music has to be shit hot as well. But I think having a story there in the beginning is quite important, or at least, you know, there's activity outside of just the music. I think, you know, Ray had a story. Her story was that, you know, she'd been at a major label for a long time. She wanted to put an album out. They didn't want her to, you know, they stifled that for whatever reason. And she wanted out. So she, you know, she went about trying to get out of that deal so that she could go and express herself and be more of a daytime, do her album, essentially, I suppose. Mm. And she's an incredible talent. But the story, you know, that was the initial story. And that was for us to be able to go and set up, you know, a Clara Ampho hottest record, her go in and do her interview and tell her story. And I think it was a story that a lot of people sort of wanted to relate to.
Yeah.
Because she was going against the major label system, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because I think maybe in days gone by, I suppose you could look at it a number of ways, but a lot of people would see it as being, you know, being rejected by the major label ecosystem. And that is not necessarily a good thing, you know, PR wise. And that definitely, you know, has not always historically been a kind of selling point for an act. So it's quite interesting to me that that was a key plus point in terms of selling and telling a story.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think, but with every record, I think that, you know, even if you break it down to the basics, you know, Sarah, when Sarah's Story came onto Radio One, like her first feature that she started was Track ID. And the whole point of the Track ID was that it was a record that had heat in clubs, that there was content for them to share about, and there was more of a story to record. Some, you know, whoever, you know, a big DJ was playing their record or hammering their record, and there was content to back that up. And I think, you know, in every sort of walk of music now, like, content's king, right? And having content to talk about, or having something specific to talk about. And I think that is the start point of every record now.
Sure.
But I think there's, you know, but still, it's not compulsory. You know what I mean? It's like, if a record's strong enough, people want to play it. I think that's kind of the rule of thumb. If it's a good enough record, people will play it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, I had a question actually about club DJs breaking records, but just before we get to that, when you say content around it, do you literally mean there's stuff for the BBC to put on their socials to support the play of a record? Is that what you mean by that?
No, I think there's just like, again, it's just really an angle or a story. You know, there's so many records out there, like, and it comes from the clubs, particularly in like electronic music, which is largely vastly the most records we work are in electronic music. And whether that's sort of a slightly more commercial MK record, or whether that's a Scuba project, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Having a story or a piece of content, even if it is just someone playing their record. I mean, like, everyone loses their head because Peggy Goo played a record. But, you know, I get labels saying to me that, you know, Danny Howard liked to post, you know, and that's not... you know what I mean? That's the levels that we're talking. It's kind of like, I think everyone's on the hustle, you know? So I think... you just got to find your way, like, with it. Social media for me is something that I've never really been massive into. I don't really post a lot about my own life. I don't really sort of have a need to put it out there, really, I suppose. But I come from an older sort of space, being 45, I suppose. Like, it's not part. I didn't grow up with it. Do you know what I mean? I didn't have a phone until I was bloody 18. Do you know what I mean? So I think for me, it's a little bit different, but, you know, it has its place in, you know, in the modern music industry.
For sure.
And everyone's looking for an angle, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which segues nicely into your club promotion or club promo question or your club DJ question.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Okay, so club DJs breaking tracks. We had A-Track on the show last week, and we talked about this issue and how it had changed, like the role of the club DJ in breaking a record. So... In the context of what you've been talking about, kind of coming out of clubs and into radio, like, what is the role of the club DJ in this particular instance, and how has it changed over time?
I think club promotion was always about a buzz of a record. You know, like, you know, in my defect days, you'd go to Miami with a fucking trunk full of records, and you wanted everyone playing your vinyl, because that was kind of like having the hottest Miami records was... you know, every label's sort of target, I suppose. You know, that's evolved, obviously, and I think now club promotion still has its place. I think the problem with that is that, one, I find like a lot of DJs now play either their own records solely, or their own edits, or, you know, they dig a bit deeper, or they don't sort of... Club promotion is important because you're getting records into DJs' hands. Mm. But there's a lot of DJs out there that won't just go and they won't just listen to promos and play promos. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How many promos do you play? Just out of curiosity.
I mean, I listen to them just to try and, you know, keep track of what's happening.
Exactly.
But in terms of what I actually play in my set, yeah, it's not super significant, I don't think. Certainly, I think it's got less significant in the last few years.
Yeah, and I think, like, look, you look out for the names that you know, and you look out for the names, but like, you know, largely you probably make the vast majority of the records you play out, maybe, or there's, you know, you're mates with an artist that, you know, are groups of artists that just send you bangers for because they want you to play in the club. And I think, obviously not when you're playing Berghain or whatever, but I think, you know, the dream for them would be still to, I still think now, is like have content of a video of you playing their record early, before they've even signed it to anyone. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Because that's the kind of desire now. It's just like, oh, social media. So you need content for that.
Yeah.
And as an artist, it must be draining, because there's two sides to it. Is, you know, one is that you don't want to sort of, you need to promote your records, but also it's like how you do that in a credible way, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real minefield, I think, particularly what has become worse like that. And it is very difficult now because, yeah, I think promos are like DJ promo, I think it's got a bit of a bad reputation. Like, I think just the volume of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the classic DJ moan on social media. It's like, oh God, I've got to go through my promos and they're all shit. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, but no, it absolutely. Is true, unfortunately. But
we all had PO boxes back in the day that were just stacked full of vinyl that you had to go through because you didn't want to miss out on a vinyl that was like, you know, a potential banger that nobody else had, you know? And I think, you know, my days at Defective was packing, my first job was sitting in Sally Rivera's studio packing vinyl for promos, and did that for a long time. But maybe music is that much more disposable now.
Well, yeah, the point I was going to make was that, you know, back in the vinyl promo days is that, you know, there's just that much higher barrier to entry there, right? So like you said, I mean, disposable is the word. I mean, but it's just a natural consequence of anyone being able to do something at basically no financial outlay or minimal financial outlay. I mean, just by definition, the supply is going to increase exponentially in that kind of environment, yeah. Right? And that just means the quality is going to go down. It has to, right? And I think it's probably fair to say that it has on average.
Yeah, because it's. I mean, I think, you know, everyone's got contactable on an email. Like, you know, you don't have everyone's home address so you can send them vinyl. Do you know what I mean? It's and I think that's, it went from vinyl to CD to digital. And for years, I just sent links to DJs via email because it was the easiest way. I think even still now, we try and do that as much as possible with DJs that aren't going to listen to, you know, go through their emails or go and listen to InFlight. But, you know, Fat Drop, when you got a first time, you used to get a Fat Drop promo, you'd be like, oh, yeah, it's a banger. But it was Fat Drop. It wasn't really the promo, I suppose.
Yeah,
you can't. I don't know. It was weird because we went through, you know, Fat Drop, and now we use InFlight for sending promos to DJs that use InFlight. Mm. But you're right; it's totally disposable. I mean, I stopped listening to promos years ago. I have to listen to a lot of records, but I stopped listening to promos years ago, but because it was just ridiculous, it was out of control.
Yeah, there's only so much bandwidth.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, look, for me, still, like, physical product still has its place. And I think...
In a very different way, though, right?
In a very different way, yeah. I think it's definitely in a better space. But again, I don't want to go off on tangent, but, like, the whole, you know, yes, music is disposable. Club promotion definitely has its place. I think it has its place more now in probably a more commercial space.
Right.
Because every DJ has his own, you know, mates list of DJs that he wants to have the record. Apart from that, I suppose that there's not really a desire to get it any further, particularly if you're running your own label. You just, like, you want to make sure that the people you want to get it. Mm. I think probably on a more commercial, not commercial, but like a more of an, I don't know, what's the word?
Yeah, I mean, sort of mainstream clubbing, right?
Yeah, not underground, I suppose, is probably not techno or not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the kind of clubs which are still sort of quite unquote proper dance music, but the big hits get played a lot, right? It's just a different kind of club, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, we still do a lot of cool underground labels, but that's where the artist runs it and doesn't really have the inclination to want to do it themselves. I think, you know, you've always done, you know, with Hot Flush, you've always done it yourself. Because you've had those relationships, you've had your Frat Drop. Do you know what I mean? It was you had a label manager, and I think,
yeah,
you know, we've always done Andy C, but we've never done club for Ram. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, that's kind of the space, and I think to break out as a new artist, you kind of need those things, I think, as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating question in itself, right? Because it's all very well talking about, you know, our label, which has been going for 20 years, and Ram, which has been going for longer. when you've got kind of an established name, it makes everything a lot easier. But when you're someone completely new, then that's, I mean, this is where the kind of the critical mass, the kind of volume really becomes difficult to break through, right?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, look, we have our sort of, I don't want this to be like a club sort of rambling conversation because we keep spiraling, but like our club promo, we take a lot of pride in that. Like we don't send records to DJs that we don't think they will play. Do you know what I mean? Like we're very specific about what we send out because people don't listen to records if you send them two records they don't like. I think that's basically the easy way to sort of describe club promotion. So we're really anal about what we send and who we send it to and what we take on to work. So we kind of, I think with new artists, you kind of rely on the fact that what you've sent to that DJ previously, they're going to like this regardless if it's a new artist or not. Do you know what I mean? So that's what we kind of pride ourselves in what we do. I don't think many people do that. Or they have, or labels that do their own promo. Realistically, it's their own label, and they might have a totally diverse sound. You know, there's no point in me sending a house record to Andy C.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's that sort of mentality, and I think that's the way that we break through artists. But I think radio comes alongside that as well.
Yeah.
But it's what we do is a lot of work in the club promotions lane because we're so anal with it.
Yeah. Okay, back to radio. You mentioned working with Doja Cat, and obviously she's one of the highest profile acts in the world, really.
Yeah.
What's my question? Is it significantly different? I mean, obviously it is out of the gate when you're working with an act with just an enormous global profile, but is it significantly different in how they view someone of that size or these enormous acts? Like, do they view radio in a significantly different way to, you know, an act which is hoping to get more, you know, hoping to like significantly raise profile through radio, for example?
It's still as much of a priority. I think when we started, Doja Cat was her second album, and at that point she was just starting to bubble, but she was nowhere near the level that she is now. At that point, obviously, that was when I think she did the deal with Sony and Ministry got her for the UK. So at that point, she was still a relatively sort of new act. It wasn't like she was, like we needed to promote it. You know, it wasn't just like a guarantee. We weren't walking onto playlists. And I think as an independent plugger, they're the sort of artists that we want to work with in that lane musically. I would put probably Doja Cat in the same space as, I don't know if you know Ants Live.
Okay.
But Ants Live is kind of in a space now, which is bubbling in a specialist world that is starting to really sort of, you know, create a swell musically, socially, and at radio. And I think it's very important for them. Now it's a very different proposition. Now it's very much like, okay, when are we going on playlist? Not how do we get to playlist?
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my question, really. With the, you know, the Paint the Town Red single, for example, I think that's the most recent one. What is the, you know, what's the conversation? Is it literally, as you just said, is it literally just like, right, where are we on this playlist?
Yeah, I mean, like that from the label perspective, definitely it's like, okay, what's the plan? What's the rollout plan? I think with Doja, you know, because of COVID as well, like there was never, she's never really been in the UK market to be able to do any sort of promo or anything.
Right.
And I think with her, it's just, there's so much online heat with her. And the last album was massive. With this project, it was very much like that. Look, when are we going on and what are we going on?
Yeah.
There was promo that we went, we did the live lounge month with her, closed that out, you know, Radio 1. Vicky from Y Team's a boss, like, has sort of led the charge on Doja. And I think the whole point of that was like, okay, we need to get, you know, Paint the Town Red on, and there's going to be other records that we'd had on pre the launch, like Instant Grats and what have you. And then when the album launched, it was very much like, okay, it was like album tracks on playlist. That's the level that she's at.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay.
And as an independent, that's actually quite rare to have an artist like that. I think that shows the sort of change in the landscape over the last few years, because previously, if you get a record, an artist to that point and they sign a deal with a major label, that artist is going in-house at the major and we won't work it again.
Got it.
It's kind of like we did Becky Hill for 8 years, and I think on her second Brit, like after her second Brit, the new album that was, started this year, that's gone in-house now. But I think, you know, labels rely on like sort of independents like us to sort of get in the trenches and grind out.
Mm.
Once they get to a level where they are a playlist act, they essentially walk on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Can you just actually, for the uninitiated, could you just describe the radio playlist system in the UK?
Essentially, there's three main national stations: KISS, Capital, and Radio 1. They all have different structures, really. KISS have quite a sort of middle ground of freedom to be able to add records to playlists based on their gut instincts and what, and then the record itself to sort of give the record a very sharp, strong start. Capital is essentially top 40 radio. And even then, top 40 doesn't guarantee ads there. It's a very sort of, you know, commercial station. It's pop. Mm. Radio 1's very different. Radio 1's very open, and because of they're not a commercial station, they can be a bit more free with their decisions of how they support artists and specific records. So you can have like a very sort of cool near archives record on Radio 1 playlist, but, you know, KISS and Capital probably won't add. And that means that's why Radio 1's specialist shows are so important, because you build records through that and move them towards that sort of daytime space. That's the sort of basis of it. I think with Radio 1, you build campaigns to a point of where they have a music team, which five people in their music team are like sort of, I suppose, the strong decision makers at Radio 1. Beyond that, you have a playlist team of 12 people that they're on as well. And if you can get a record to a position that it feels hot enough and relevant enough for Radio 1, you'll go in for a discussion, for our playlist discussion. And it's quite hard.
Mm.
It's quite hard to get to that point. You know, you need sort of good amount of plays. You need a track of the week, for example. That's kind of the basics of it. I could go into real depth with it.
Those, just taking that Radio 1 example or instance, I mean, you mentioned that it's getting on those playlists is contingent on the existing performance on the station. Like, how much of it is like lobbyable by someone like you going in as a plugger and hoping to sort of sway their decisions? Like, how much influence are you able to wield in there, realistically?
You're talking about conversations that happen over maybe like 2 or 3 months in some cases, maybe longer in some cases.
Yep.
So it's not us going, you need to add this, because you need to demonstrate, first of all, there has to be passion for the record. And if there isn't passion for the record, that you need stats to be able to prove that that record needs to be heard by their audience on a broader scale. My missus takes the piss out of me all the time, because during lockdown, it was like, well, passion over stats all the time. And that's kind of it, really. It's either passion or you've got the stats. And that's why it's very hard. I'm trying to think of it, because obviously we work a lot of cool stuff as well, so we should probably talk about that. But I am talking a lot more about sort of the commercial stuff we do.
Yeah, no, sure. I'm fascinated by this. So yeah, please. Well, continue.
I think like there was a really good example of Lude. I don't know if you ever heard the Lude record, Man Down Under. And like, I loved it when I heard it on his SoundCloud, and I hit up his manager and was like, look, you should do this. And they were like, do you think? And I was like, I think it's fucking amazing. They managed to clear it. And in like the first 2 weeks before Christmas, it was like late in December, it was like no one wanted to touch it with a barge pole. Like everyone was like, I like it, but I can't play it. It was kind of the stance on it from everybody. It was really tough. And I was gutted because I thought, yes, it was really cheesy in a sense that it's a well-known sample, but it was done so well. Anyway, we went away on Christmas, came back in January, and I remember going into the office on the first day back and being like, fuck, it was like 23 in Shazam. And then we looked at the midweek chart for the UK chart, and I think it was something like 50 in the chart, and I was like, what the fuck has happened here? And largely what had happened during Christmas, him and his like manager and all his mates got COVID, and they were locked down in this like flat in Australia. And they were just fucking about on social media, and essentially it went viral. And essentially that gave the impetus for me to be able to go back to radio and go, there you go, mate. Like there's the stats there to back it up. And I think I remember talking to Danny Howard about it, and he was like, yeah, look, I like it, but I can't play it. And then back in January, he was like, yeah, I can give this a spin now. It makes more sense to me. And that's like public demand, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of an example of where it kind of works.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's almost a novelty record though, right, I guess?
Yeah, it is. But like, there was labels hitting me up going, why didn't you send me this? Like, because if I'd sent it to you, you'd have told me to piss off. Now that there's the stats there to back it up, it kind of,
Everyone's swayed by stats, right?
Yeah. And look, unfortunately now, I think, particularly in like sort of commercial music, they are swayed by stats.
Not just commercial music.
No, I suppose it works for, you know, club bookings and, it's, I remember when it Beatport number one was like meant, like it was like you were a hot act. I don't know how it reflects now, but I think, yeah, people look at monthly listeners now it's a very difficult space because there are so many stats.
Yeah, I think the big problem is that there isn't one metric that really tells you the whole picture.
No, exactly that.
So give me an example of what's the most quote-unquote underground records that you've got on a playlist or you've seen go on one of those big playlists?
I mean, we worked this really shit record by a guy called Scuba. I think it was Hard Body. I mean, we had to polish a turd. We had to roll it in glitter, mate.
I mean, that wasn't that underground. I would.
No, it wasn't. That was probably the most overground record you've ever done.
Yeah.
But I think that was a really good example of that. Like, it wasn't, it was very not underground for you, but at the time.
I mean, yeah, I didn't have a vocal on. That's, I guess, like a big.
Yeah. And we managed to sneak that onto playlist in a quieter period, like over Christmas. I think it was January we managed to get it away. That's a really good example.
Yeah.
Like there was passion for the record.
Yeah.
You know, like I think I've worked with Prids for years. Like he years ago, he was just like, it was the hardest act because he was always seen in like the sort of that space at the time as probably quite underground. It wasn't by your standards, I suppose, but radio just didn't want to know. But now it's like they would snap your arm off for a big Prince record, and I think times change a lot. I suppose someone like Frankie Wah is probably the most recent in terms of, and he's again not fully underground, but there's definitely records we've got on playlist that were down to passion.
All right.
I think someone like Baklava is, you know, female act, you know, in a more sort of, I suppose, garage space. We worked really hard to build her as an artist proposition. We're getting records away that aren't doing numbers at all, but she has a proposition to her. You know, she's a brilliant artist and a brilliant vocalist. And I think those records where they're not doing any stats are the bigger wins for us, really, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because you're getting it away based on passion. And look, to answer your question in a long-winded rambly way. I suppose, yeah, we do have impact at radio, and we do because we're, I suppose, a trusted source of information and a trusted source of relationships. We're not aggressive. I think major labels probably have to be aggressive. Major label internal pluggers have to be aggressive because that's their job internally. Mm. Ours is to maintain relationships between the artist, the manager, the label, and radio. But we chip away.
Yeah.
And I think radio respect that. You know, it's not that we take no for an answer. It's just we know we. What do you want from this? What do you want from us? We'll go and make it happen.
Yeah.
Type of vibe, I suppose.
Sure.
And yeah, so look, and as I suppose, you know, we're a trusted source of, you know, music in whatever lane it is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a peripheral question to that I had was, is it possible to deliver a successful radio campaign without using a specialist group like you guys? Obviously, it's different from the majors, but like, you know, as a small independent label, is it absolutely necessary to hire a specialist radio plugger to have success at radio?
Depends what you define as success, I suppose. Like if you've got you know, you're a small independent label and you're getting a play on Radio One, a play on Radio One,
yep,
is success for your first release on your new label, and you're an unknown artist. That's amazing, and if you can do that, that's great, because you might know a producer or a presenter. I think there's there's a lot more to it than that. Like,
sure.
And I think we do campaigns where, you know, and it's rare that we'll do campaigns where it goes badly. It might not go well or as well as we would like it to, but I don't really think every campaign ever sort of goes as well as you'd like it to until it's a number one record, I suppose.
Right.
Case in point, that Casso record with Ray and D-Block on it, I mentioned earlier, you know, we worked that for months. It was number two for 6 weeks. We couldn't get it to number one. It got trumped twice by two different records. We couldn't get it to number one. And actually coming out of the campaign, it's a bit of a fail. But the record's platinum and it's been number two in the chart and every A-list on every radio station. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Yeah.
It felt like a bit of a fail because of that. I think for an independent, again, it's what you want out of it. I think I'm working a lot more with artists, I suppose, now, more so even in a very much more underground space. Mm. I say we as a team,
yep,
and my team are the nuts. Like, well, I can do what I do without them. I think we want to build artists, not necessarily just records. Obviously, the one-off records have their place, but I think building artists is something we've really worked hard on over the last few years, and that's in whatever lane it is.
Yeah,
you know, trying to get them to, I suppose, Sammy Virgie's a good example because he's sort of come from this sort of garagey underground space and gone on to do a major label deal, but still is only really just getting started. And he's like a really, like, he's an act that I feel like has a long-term future because he's, you know, he's both credible and commercial, and I suppose underground and commercial rather than credible and commercial. But, you know, Frankie Wire is someone that I've worked with for years, and like, I would call him a mate. Like, that was in a major label space, was really sort of comfortable there, wanted to do his own thing, and has gone off and done that in the last 2 years, and just building on his profile over that time. You know, that's interesting, and that's what I feel like he's become more important than just working with a label as such.
Yeah, I mean, that project's really, really successful, isn't it? It's really flown.
Mm. I think, like, you know, you've been in your game doing what you do for a lot longer. I suppose, you know, when we were doing that album, what was the album?
Personality, the one that, yes, the one we got playlisted on. Yeah. Actually, no, it wasn't, was it? It was Hard Body, which was the single that came after Personality, but wasn't on the album.
Well, Hard Body was the single. What was the album?
Personality was the album, but Hard Body, yeah, wasn't, yeah, actually on the album. It was a single that came out later.
Oh, right, okay.
But yes, but it was that era anyway. But yeah, it was definitely that kind of period of time, for sure.
But that, again, that was, and that, I think it's, that was a, that I would say it's a similar sort of trajectory as where, mm, Frankie Wire's come from, I suppose. Obviously in a different lane musically, but,
yep,
still just sort of made it his own. And I think that's what you had at that, you know, that point. You, everything you've done has very much been your own.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
At that point,
yeah.
Pop Russia was like the independent label that nobody else was doing or was having as much success with as kind of you were, I suppose. The label stood out.
Yeah.
It was the whole package. Do you know what I mean?
For sure. That was a good moment. Absolutely. So we mentioned streaming before and I had that as a topic of discussion. So I have reflected on the show in the past that streaming is basically just radio. Do you agree with that to any extent?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Give me that argument against.
To digest it, yeah, but to discover it, no.
Okay.
I think. Look, everything has its place, and I think Spotify is in the streaming space is very different to Apple Music and very different to probably Amazon now, which are sort of starting to really sort of do good things. Mm. I don't think it can be classed as the same. I think the best comparison I can give it to you is in lockdown. I think when it first happened, no one really knew what was going on. It wasn't. I think everyone thought it was 2 weeks long. Sure. I think it was going to be 2 weeks and we were back to work, right? And for me at that point was like, sort of running our own business, it was like, fuck, what does this mean for us? And I think at that point it was like, everyone needed radio because it gave personality and it gave someone in the room with you. And it wasn't just music. It was like comms with the outside world, I suppose. Mm. That was in COVID, but I think what that actually meant was that as well is that radio presenters are supposed to be educators, and look, some aren't and some are. I still religiously listen to Pete Tong every week. I just have done since God knows how long, way before I was working in music. I was DJing then, but like way before I was working in music. And I think that's because it's always, with him, it's always felt like a bit of an education, or regardless of the changes in sound and what have you, it feels like there's he's someone that's going to influence my taste in music because he has an opinion on it. I think with streaming, if it's algorithmically, playlists are algorithmically created, which takes out that total, which takes out ears and, making a decision on a record that you feel should be heard.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any amount of AI or algorithm that really I feel I need to be educated by, I suppose. And that's not just because I'm a plugger. I think that's streaming is it absolutely has its place, but I still find it quite a minefield. I still buy a shitload of vinyl because someone will post about a record, or it's a record that I missed when I was buying records back in the day and there was no Discogs. Do you know what I mean? Or I'll hear a record in a club and I can Shazam it, as sad as that sounds, because I want to own it. But I think radio still has that sort of educating part to it.
Yeah.
That I don't really feel streaming does have.
Yeah. Okay. I can accept those those points.
You accept those terms.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I agree with you on all those points. I'm not sure that I'm not sure how much of radio listening is of that sort, I guess, would be my kind of like pushback to that. Like, so yeah, there are absolutely great radio DJs who add a huge amount of value to listening to something, which is, which you're absolutely right. You don't get that from listening to a Spotify playlist or whatever. Even if that Spotify playlist has been curated by an editor and that editor is really good, it's just not quite the same, I think, probably. That's probably fair.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much of the average, the average minute that is listened to of radio, I don't know how much of that is of that sort of listening. And the same for streaming. Like, so much of streaming listenership is passive, right? It's not someone who kind of goes out and listens to something explicitly or intentionally. And I think if there was an overlap, and I do think there's an overlap, it's that, right? It's the kind of person who just sticks on the radio in the car, right? And that might as well just be a Spotify playlist. I guess that's where I'm coming from with that.
Yeah, I suppose I get that. But I think one drives the other, mm-hmm. not the other way around. So, radio does drive streaming.
Right.
Which is arguably the business that we're in, which is, records, So from your side, you listen to a record on radio, you can Shazam it, or the presenter's told you about it. so you can hear what the name is, and you may then go to your playlist, go to Spotify or whatever platform you use, and search for that record and add it to your own playlist. I don't think it works the other way.
Sure. Yeah.
It doesn't work the other way.
Yeah. Okay.
And as much as...
So hang on a second. Let me ask you something about that. Do you never have a track which has for some reason gone viral on streaming, which does happen occasionally, which then translates into a big radio record rather than the other way around?
Not on... Yes, but that's come from a social media
right.
viral moment, okay. Not from a streaming viral moment.
Okay, so there's the social origin...
Media, that social media drives the streaming, but it's not necessarily... There's thousands of records like that.
Yeah.
We've got one on the go at the moment, but like I think...
You mean originally it comes from TikTok, not from streaming, and that's the kind of important bit, right?
Yeah, it's come from social media. It hasn't come from... Yeah. Streaming.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
The social media's drained like this swell of sort of activity and buzz, which has then, you know, fed into the streaming of the record. But it's not, and that comes back with the social media to us and that social media and streaming plot. But yeah, I just feel like radio gives more. And I don't think, look, I listen to radio a lot because it's my job, I suppose. Radio is a bit more, it's easier to discover stuff because someone's going to put it in your face, but I'll listen to Benji or I'll listen to Giles or I'll listen to Pete or I do listen to Danny's show and Sarah's show. That for me personally makes me discover music that I wouldn't have heard before. There's not loads that I'll go and buy a record off of hearing it on the radio. There's not loads of times that will happen. You know, and bearing in mind, we listen to NTS in the office, we listen to Rinse or we listen to, you know, those are the spaces as well. That's radio as well. And that does have impact because that's more specialist and more sort of headsy. I think the sort of Radio 1s and Kiss and Capitals of the world, they open up people to music they probably wouldn't listen to before because they grew up listening to Capital FM because it's pop music.
Sure. Okay, you mentioned socials there, and I've got to ask because it's what everyone talks about. Like, what is the influence of TikTok and have you seen it grow?
Yeah, Hugh, I mean, like, on anything specific or sort of just what I do?
Well, I mean, just what we were talking about, I suppose. You mentioned the kind of the impact of records that really blow up on socials, and I think TikTok's probably the most important one for that phenomenon. How has this thing developed and how significant is it?
Yeah, it's very significant, but I think it's sort of significant to, you know, in a very sort of strange way, I suppose. Look, you upload a sound to TikTok, the content that's in front of it, if something connects, it's shared. Mm. And the sound becomes the background to whatever is shared. So whether that's your own video or a video that someone else has made or something stupid or whatever, it becomes a sound that relates to that moment.
Yep.
That organically generates Shazam, which is really important on a radio's perspective because it's a general sort of way that you can see it's demonstrated, but that there's general interest in what that record is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whether it's played on radio or it's heard on social media. So Shazam, that triggers a lot of Shazam. There's records that are on TikTok that may have done a million video creations or whatever it is that don't stream. So you can have an isolated TikTok viral moment, but it doesn't really turn a record into a hit. Mm. I think it's the ones that progress onto being sort of streaming hits that then progress on from there are the ones that impact. That said, I don't think many people really care at radio if it's had a million video creations or it's been tagged 1 billion times on TikTok. Because the reality is it's still got to cross into a sales space for them to sort of buy in.
Okay, and presumably if it has translated to significant Shazams, then that would be a big deal.
Yeah, because that's a good start point for us at radio, you know. Like I mentioned on the Lude record before, like...
Yeah, that's a real indication that the record is like catching people's attention, right? I mean, it doesn't get any more tactile than that, right? It's made someone pick up their phone and hit the Shazam button, right?
Absolutely. And like pre-Shazam, it was a very different world, but Shazam, it gives you, as I said, it's a bona fide reaction to a record being played wherever it is. there was moments where, like, a Love Island record would get, like, it would just fly up a Shazam chart. You know, it's played for 30 seconds. So if someone's managed to tag it in that time, you know, impressive, but that's a desire to tag what and find out what that record is.
Yeah.
And different things impact different spaces. I think, like, there was a point where they were doing, you know, we would look through sort of from July to sort of September, we look at Ibiza Shazam to see what the trends are there. If there's a particular record that stands out in Ibiza, labels do that. I do it because if a label's going to sign a record, I want to work it. So I'm on that sort of, I'm looking for those sorts of things. But the Shazam is a good, is a good gauge for a good tool for me to be able to go to radio and say, look, this is reactive. There's a record by an act called Zurb that just his album dropped like not that long ago, largely unheard of act, very, very new, very fresh. One record socially popped off and it flew up Shazam, you know, and no one at radio had played it at that point. We took, you know, we were talking to the label already. We took the record on. We've gone to radio and it's feeling really strong. And, you know, the way that it's moving now, that will probably go on after all the Christmas records drop out of the chart. We'll probably go on and into the chart in sort of January. But that was the start point. It was like, I'll go to Danny or go to, you know, we go to radio shows and you know, it's 40-inch Shazam. Like, you know, this is a heat record. And there isn't any other record around that's doing that at the moment.
Sure. Yeah. Let me just, I just want to go back to streaming for a moment. A question I had written down, which I would actually be really interested in, was...
Did you prepare for this?
Mate, I've got a massive list of notes. I'm diligent in my preparation for these podcasts.
Are your editing skills going to need to be really strong as well?
Now, I wanted to ask, like, as a company, was there ever a point where you really saw streaming as a threat to your kind of core business?
I don't think so, no. It's obviously there, but I don't think the
numbers... Did you always have the same kind of opinion of...
Has it ever changed? Like, radio just seems to keep growing. I suppose from the outside looking in, you would think that might be a concern, but I actually don't see it that way at all. Like, radio is sort of... The numbers keep increasing constantly.
Right.
And whether that is, like, you know, a white van man or people listening to it in a warehouse or listening to it in their office, I think... Radio is still, I still put the radio on, like, and I know that's me again, but I think the numbers on that side of things, on like radars and what have you, no, I think both have their place. It's kind of just, I've always seen it as funny because I've always seen it as two different formats, really.
Sure, sure.
Like, I always listen to radio, bought vinyl, but I still listen to radio. And look, I think there's, you know, there's a lot of crap radio, there's a lot of good radio. And I think actually things like, you know, DAB and like app-based radio or radio stations that have an app that you can go and listen to again to specific shows is actually a really strong media.
Mm.
And to be honest with you, if I was that concerned about it, I probably wouldn't be still a radio plugger.
Sure. I mean, I guess my question really was, well, an element of my question was like, was there ever a point where you didn't have the view of streaming that you gave? But I mean, from what you're saying, that it's been pretty consistent.
Yeah. Do you know what? Streaming just came out of the blue, I suppose. And do you know what? Actually, also, when I was at Defected, and I was there for a long time, so I weathered a lot of different spells.
Yeah.
Or we weathered a lot of different spells. And that, like, that sort of transition from selling vinyl to... selling CDs, from selling CDs to, you know, Beatport. And I think when streaming came in, it was just kind of like, oh, it's another media platform that we're going to have to sort of figure out how to use. You know, the digital, physical to digital transition was brutal.
Yeah.
For labels back then. You know, vinyl was dead and no one was doing any sales, apparently. You know, we still did sales, but we weren't doing as much. But I think that's the same with streaming now. Is I think it's just, for me, I just see it as a consumption platform rather than anything more than that. I use Spotify, but I don't sit and build playlists, but I suppose that's just my personal opinion. You know how hard it is with Spotify to get sort of added to playlists and get sort of profile and build streams on that platform, on any streaming platform. Radio's promotion is profile, and it's a bit more to it than that. which is weird because, it, you know, as much as it is mostly digital now, it's still an analog media form. Do you know what I mean? But no, in the short answer, which you can just cut all of that out and just say, I don't think I've really ever massively been concerned about streaming taking over, because I suppose 90% of the 99% of the time I'm listening to labels, you know, moaning about the fact that they haven't got a profile on streaming and they need radio to move the record, I suppose.
I don't know what you're talking about. So I had a question about demographics, actually. You mentioned that radio numbers have really held up. What's the demographic picture there?
Yeah.
Is it healthy with regards to young people coming in and supporting and kind of like getting involved in the medium? What does it look like from that perspective?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's definitely young. I mean, I think Radio 1's demographic 16 to 25 is their target demographic.
But what do you know what that kind of works out as in terms of what it actually is?
Well, the splits off the top of my head, absolutely not. Because though, you know, I could find it, Radar, you could definitely dig it. I could definitely dig it out. I don't think that for me doing what I do is that relevant, other than the fact that I suppose the only thing that I would say things have changed is that the presenting styles have changed, or the presenting sort of.
Okay. In what way?
I think delivering, I mean, look, you could listen to Radio 1, Radio 2, 6 Music and Radio 4 if you want. You can tell the differences in the way that those shows are presented and the types of characters.
Yeah, there's a kind of house style for each one, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, Radio 1 is definitely geared towards a younger audience and a bit more bantery and a bit more sort of young banter in that sense. You know, Radio 2 is a bit more older and, you know, looking at, you know, that 30 plus demographic that plays records from when you were 16, 17, 18 or whatever. And I suppose the presenters that are used in that, and I'm talking on a commercial daytime level here, you can tell it's a bit more mature. You know, you listen to Radio 4, my missus insists on listening to it in the morning. It's definitely a sort of more informed, older demographic target. 6 Music is that sort of cooler left vibe, you know, look, Giles and Benji's presenting styles, you know, or whatever, Benji's, you know what I mean? You know, Specialist is quite like, is you know, still sort of, it's cooler on Radio 1 and on Friday night. You know, you know, Danny has his presenting style, Sarah has hers, Pete has his. You know, I think in a specialist world, they have their sort of voice of authority in the lane that they present and that show that they do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I always thought that Pete was much cooler than Jules. Sorry, Jules. This is the way that he presented and the sound that he played. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Absolutely. It was funny that, I don't know if you listened to the Trevor Jackson episode a couple of weeks ago, but he was extolling the virtues of Judge Jules as a DJ in his early days. I didn't realize that Judge Jules was such a credible DJ before he joined Radio 1 and started playing trance, but I mean, that's another story.
Yeah, but the thing is, do you know what? Because it went, I think it was Pete, Jules, although Seb was there obviously for a bit, but Dave...
Pierce.
I was going to say Clark, but that's definitely not the same. And then Dave Pierce. So it was kind of like, it kind of went through the cool stages, if you know what I mean. I was never a trance head. I was certainly never a Dave Pierce sort of commercial sort of space dance head at that point. But Pete was always like the start point of the evening.
Right.
So I think on that sort of level, it was the same then, really. It was kind of credible. I don't know. And I think radio's changed, and I'm not saying that it's the same as it is now, but it's changed. Each show has its own place, and it's on at that time presenting music for that time. I think when Annie left, Radio 1 wanted that 6 o'clock show to be more commercial. So, you know, and I think Danny went straight into that knowing full well what that was about. And he's a brilliant presenter. But it's a different sound to what Sarah plays. It's a different sound to what Pete plays, but it's presented in a different way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. Well, listen, I wanted to finish up by talking about your time at Defected, which we have touched upon. But as you mentioned, it was in a very tumultuous period in the dance scene, particularly in the music industry generally, but I think particularly in the dance scene. Like you said, the switch between switch from vinyl, kind of vinyl associated business model to downloads prior to streaming.
and obviously all the file sharing and stuff. But how did you get the job at Defected? What was that, your first job in music?
It was my first, like, where was I? I suppose it wasn't my first job. Do you remember Paul Jackson? You probably remember him. Ministry resident. He was signed to Underwater, and he was,
yeah, okay, yeah,
kid stuff with Influential, which was Defected's sister label. He was a DJ full time. I followed him around for a long time. Drove him up and down the M1.
All right, okay.
And I was, you know, obviously was DJing off the back of that, and not off the back of him, but like I got into DJing because of that. And I lived with a guy called Tony Tambourine, who was at the time the press guy at Turnmills.
Yep.
And I used to DJ there a lot. I was at the Cross a lot, and Pasha and Ministry and what have you. And then I kind of was like, I wasn't working. I was just DJing like 3-4 nights a week. And we had a flat together, and he became the Defected press guy. And he was like, mate, I just basically sat listening to records Monday to Wednesday and DJed the rest of the week, did fuck all, thought I was going to do it forever. And he was just like, mate, you got to get a job. I was like, I don't want a job. He was like, why don't you come and intern at Defected? And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And I worked, because I ran my own party called Soda at Madame Jojo's on a Sunday morning, and I worked in the events team for a bit, and then I started working as Dunmore's A&R assistant, I suppose. He didn't have an assistant, so I was, I suppose, his assistant. And did that for a couple of years, and then I worked with a guy called Tony Garvey, who's, you know, was the promotions guy. He was the promotions manager, head of promotions, actually, for a couple more years, and then he left to go into management, and I took over as promotions manager.
What did that actually entail? What was the work of a promotions manager in those days?
Pretty much what I do now, really. Maybe a bit more frontline, and a bit more sort of creative, in terms of, because you weren't just radio plugging or doing club promotion, you were, you know, doing everything to do with the brand label. I think at that time, Defected basically had this label services sort of structure, because everything had gone to digital and they weren't making anywhere near the money they were before. They went to this sort of label services structure because we had the infrastructure. And so we took on like Axtone, Subliminal, Strictly Rhythm, Junior Boyzone, Size, loads of really cool labels as well, like old labels, Fourth Floor, Suburban, from the States. And as much as I loved it, and the vast majority of the music, not all of it, I think I just felt like it was a bit of a conveyor belt of putting records out, because digital, you needed to sort of work so much harder and do so much more to make money, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think, look, ultimately that was the reason I left, but I think like I learned everything there. I hadn't used a PC since I was at like school. I had a Mac. I mean, MySpace was probably the most complicated thing that I ever did before that.
So how long were you at Defected for in total?
8 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
I mean, like Sandy Rivera, we were opposite Black Market Records. So like I met everyone that I'm still friends with. You know, Sandy Rivera had his studio in the basement, wrote his, you know, all the Black Wiz releases and his first album on Defected, as Kings of Tomorrow. Like I sat in a studio packing records while he was writing his album. It was that sort of level of madness. So it was really cool. Got a lot of promos. I used to go to the Black Market with like a box of tests and just trade up with Goldie and just get a load of records for just, and then go and see Ewan from like Ewan and Spencer Parker in Uptown. And yeah, it was just like a little, it was culturally, it was mental. It was so good. But things changed when it all went digital.
Right.
I remember when we did like Dimitri from Paris in the House compilation, and Amato, who's a distributor, their warehouse burned down and all the stock went, and Defected nearly went under because of that. I don't think people really sort of see that side of it. Defected nearly went under. I mean, like there was, you know, some hairy moments, but like learned everything. I've learned a lot more since leaving there, but every day's a school day, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so last question.
Go on. Was that a good answer? I don't even know if that was a good answer to the book.
I mean, it wasn't really much of a question. I was just asking you to talk about it, and you talked about it. So yeah, it was good. I mean, we have talked about it in the course of the conversation too. But yeah, the last question I had was, and this is relevant to what you just said, actually, like what advice would you give to a kid wanting to get into the music industry today? What would you tell them to do?
As an artist or to work in music, to work in the industry?
I think to work in music, yeah. Because it's one thing, yeah, it's one thing just wanting to make tunes. I mean, fine. But like, yeah, if someone who wants to, you know, someone who loves going out, loves the whole thing, just wants to be involved.
Yeah. Work hard, graft. I think that's largely all I ever did. Just work hard.
Right. It almost doesn't matter what area you're in. Yeah, just work hard and learn what you can. Yeah.
Yeah. I think like I do anything you can to learn. Like I don't have a degree. I dropped out of college. Like, I mean, I thought I was going to be a DJ, and I was for a long period of time until I realized that unless I made records and spent a lot of time learning that, I wasn't going to be, which I've, you know, done as well. But I think, yeah, I think it's just work hard, man, and be passionate. And, you know, I've got an amazing team. Like, we built a company, like the radio team and my streaming team are like, I suppose, 14 people now. And every single one of those, bar me and Luke, have been interns or assistants at some point. And that in itself is sort of testament to the fact that all three of my heads of department were in my interns and are amazing at what they do. And everyone in the team has come through that process. And I think everyone thinks the music industry is all bants and like party, party, party. It's hard work. And I think, you know, the young team kids that come through, like we look after them because they work hard. Mm. And I think be passionate. Like, have your heart side hustles, you know. I think everyone's got their side hustles. Like Vicky's my head of department, she's got her own podcast. Eski, he's just stopped working with us now to go into management. You know, he's got a show on Rinse FM. Tia was on, I think, NTS. Tia's like, you know, screams girl. Like, she plays all over the country, all over the world at the moment. She's DJing a lot. Ned's a producer. Like, you know what I mean? It's like everyone's got their passions, but I think, like, you know, having a job is kind of structure and just work hard.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Anyway, this has been awesome. Thanks for your time, Jack. It's been great.
Yeah, I hope it was helpful, mate. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, that was James Jackson, Managing Director of Press, Radio and Club, and I think streaming as well. I mean, he's just kind of like running the show, I think, at this point at Listen Up. Luke Neville, I think, founded the agency. Yeah, he definitely founded it. And I remember meeting those guys back in, well, we mentioned the Personality album campaign that I did back in 2012. And they were sort of, I guess, the first people that I met in this section of the industry. And they're just very nice people, generally speaking, and really know their stuff, as you will have gathered from that conversation with Jacko. So yeah, we haven't talked about that stuff before on the show. It's really, really great to cover it. We did cover it in some detail. And from different areas too, it's great to hear about working with an act as big as Doja Cat. And yeah, just very, very interesting, really, on a number of levels. So yeah, really good episodes. That was episode 99. Hold tight for episode 100 or whatever happens next week. Have a great holiday. I'm not going to speak to you again before Christmas. So if you celebrate Christmas, have a good Christmas. If you don't, then have a good holiday. And yeah, remember you can support the show if you're enjoying it. Patreon.com/ScubaOfficial for subscriptions and for one-off donations. You know, it's that time of year. ScubaOfficial.io/support for PayPal, credit cards, whatever. I really do hate saying credit cards. It sounds so much worse than PayPal. It genuinely does. But anyway, yeah, if you want to support us, then those are the ways you can do it. There's also a Spotify playlist, which you can follow via a link in the show notes. And join us in the Discord. Come and say happy holidays in the Discord. Hotflushrecordings.com/Discord gets you through to that Discord server. And if you're a Patreon member, then there is some private areas that you can get to, but anyone could just join the server. So yeah, do that and come and say hello. Come and say how you're doing, etc. Okay, this has been a good episode. Two guest episodes for the first time. I think for the first time. Yeah. Establishing new precedents. I will be back here same time, same place next week for the next episode of a Not a Diamond podcast. Thanks.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.